Hey everyone, welcome to the 380th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we are coming to you, well, half of the team is coming to you live from Paris, Paris. The other half is live from Harleysville.
Yes, and you can guess who is where.
Exactly. I'm in Paris. Okay. And so I'm going to apologize. You might hear some weird noises. I am recording from a hotel room. It's a little less than optimal. You'll hear something similar with my guest. My guest is actually on his vacation. He is British and he is by the seaside. So you'll get some really lovely ambiance throughout this podcast. All right. This week, we've got a bunch of news. We're going to be talking about Wink and where is it? Hive, which is the UK's British Gas smart home effort, is shutting down some of their devices. We're going to be talking about the city of San Francisco and its efforts to increase surveillance using smart home gear. We're also getting an update on Senator Markey's probe into Amazon Ring devices. And the FTC is coming out saying that they're the ones who should really be enforcing privacy law, and we'll talk about what that means. Home Assistant is announcing a new program and is going to work with Matter, and BMW is going to sell subscriptions for heated seats, which is a pretty controversial topic. So we're going to be talking about all of these options and perhaps a few more things in this week's episode. We're also going to hear from our sponsor, Influx Data, and our guest, who is Pilgrim Beert, the CEO of Device Pilot. We're going to be talking about what comes next for the smart grid. And again, there'll be those seagulls. So stay tuned for all of this. But first, a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Intent. Are you developing an app for a connected device? When you partner with Intent, you don't just work with the build team. We're going to act as a think partner to guide your hardware project to success. Intent has more than 12 years of experience in delivering stunning IoT and connected device projects, including the Aura Ring and Bose and the Macintosh in-car entertainment systems. With an extensive background in mobile and web app development, firmware and hardware, Intent helps design and build software solutions for the world of connected devices, from net new ideas to products entering an established niche. You can see all of their stories at withintent.com/portfolio. Okay, Kevin, let's start off with Wink. My gosh, we should have done this story last week, but who knew it would happen and be down for this long? But July 1st, Wink went down. For those of y'all who haven't been in the smart home journey for the last, 10 years, Wink was developed probably back in 2013, I think is when it launched. It was part of GE had a division called Quirky. They launched connected products, and then they launched a connected home hub called Wink. They did two iterations of it. I had both. Yeah, and they were great. They were like kind of like SmartThings or Revolve back at the time. They had Zigbee, they had Z-Wave. Wink had the added benefit of having a Lutron radio in there, so it acted like a Lutron bridge. And I loved that hub so much that actually when Quirky went bankrupt, Will.i.am bought Wink. Then Will.i.am said, hey, you know what? If you want to keep using Wink, you're going to have to pay us a monthly subscription. I actually paid that for probably a year and a half, and I stopped a couple months ago.
Yeah, that was, I think, for quite a while, both of our platforms of personal choice, quite honestly.
Yeah, it was great.
It was, and then it wasn't, and now it isn't, because even people are still paying their $5 a month, and yet Wink has been down since July 1, as you said, and their status page, which must be hosted somewhere else because Wink's internet presence is just gone. Like their homepage is gone. Everything is just unreachable. But their status page is up and they said on the 1st of July, they've identified the issue and they're working on a fix. Nothing said or updated until July 12th, which was Tuesday of this week. And it says, we are continuing to work on a fix for our connectivity issues. We will post here when we have a resolution. So clearly there are connectivity issues. I don't know if there's financial issues or other issues, but I know a lot of people are not happy right now.
This can't help but remind me of Insteon, and Insteon just suddenly going dark for everybody. But unfortunately, Wink did not have a lot of local control. I mean, yes, they have Zigbee and Z-Wave, but that hub was connected to the cloud and all your automations were in the cloud. So
yes. The good thing is, if you're a Wink user, obviously it's not a good situation right now, but if you don't restart your Wink hub, whatever local smart home control you had, you still have. But once you restart the hub, which I'm sure most people probably did with the outage, you lose even the local stuff that you had.
Yeah, I wonder if we're going to have to say, hey, you know what? You know, reboot was always like, you know, anytime I have a computer issue or any sort of technology issue, I'm like, okay, let's just reboot it. Maybe that's no longer the thing to do in the smart home.
Not with a device that is cloud connected, no.
Yeah, okay. So let's say we're like, you know what, Wink, this is too much. And the last time Wink went down, they actually have historically had some pretty long outages. They went down for like a week back when I was paying for them still. And they gave me $1 off, which was nice, I guess.
Yeah, for a $5 monthly fee, that's in the range. That's reasonable.
So it was like they prorated it, but I feel like I don't know if you want to keep riding this horse into the sunset, y'all. So what are some options if you don't, Kevin?
The good news is you do have a lot of options, and some of them are good enough that you'll even be able to reuse a lot of your existing smart home connected devices. Me personally, you know, I'm very happy with HomeKit. So if you're an iPhone user, I'd say move over to HomeKit. Yeah, you're going to probably lose a lot of...
Zigbee and Z-Wave stuff.
Yeah, you'll end up, you know, losing a lot of those devices for sure. But you're gaining security, more local control, known Matter support coming, etc. That's an option.
And I should just mention, Wink has not come out and said anything about Matter, which means that you might, when Matter comes out, not get compatibility going forward. You might. I don't know. We just literally hear nothing from Will.i.am's group on Wink.
If you want to do something else that would bring in non-HomeKit devices to HomeKit, you could consider Homebridge. And that's free software that you run on a PC or a Raspberry Pi. Basically, it's like a little server that has well over 2,000 plugins that bring non-HomeKit supported devices to HomeKit. So if there is a way to reuse some of those devices if you decide to go down the HomeKit path. And if installing software is not your thing, which is what you have to do with Homebridge, you could buy a Hoobs box, which is Hoobs stands for Homebridge out of the box, I believe. It's $249. It's basically a Raspberry Pi with the software pre-installed, the Homebridge software. You could do it. I don't think I would spend the $250 because I don't think the installation is too difficult. So that is an option. If you don't want to go HomeKit, that's totally fine. You could consider Home Assistant or Hubitat. One started out as software. Home Assistant started out as software that you would pre-install or rather install on a Raspberry Pi. Now you can buy Home Assistant on a box, a little Pi. It's called now the Yellow. It used to be called the Amber.
Well, so they have one called the Blue, and then the Yellow is coming out later this year. It used to be called the Amber, and last week we talked about it and referred to it as Amber, but they renamed it sometime in the last few months, and now it is the Home Assistant Yellow.
Okay. So I actually did test Home Assistant recently on a Raspberry Pi, and it's pretty powerful. Again, you get lots of plugins to bring in other devices. Note that a Raspberry Pi has Bluetooth and Wi-Fi typically. It's not going to have other radios. But you can add via USB dongle, say a Zigbee or a Z-Wave radio, and make some of your existing devices work with Home Assistant. And I do want to mention, only because people are paying $5 for Wink, you can use Home Assistant without paying anything. However, if you want remote access, they offer a service called Nabucasa, and that's $6.50 a month. I believe it's cheaper if you pay annually. So it's something to consider in the decision-making process. If you want to go cheaper and no subscription, we've tested the Hubitat, which is a physical hub. It's pretty nice as well. And again, you would get Zigbee and Z-Wave. Doesn't have Bluetooth, to my knowledge, and it doesn't have Wi-Fi either. It uses a wired Ethernet connection. I don't think that's a major showstopper, but for some people who, you know, don't want to put this near a router, I can understand this would be a problem. But it's $99.95 for the software and the hardware, and it also supports all the major voice assistants. So, you know, whatever you want to use, you're good to go. It's gotten better, too. I didn't care for it at first, about 2 years ago when I first tried it, but it has gotten better, broader range of support. So, and then finally, I mean, you could just go all in with Amazon or Google, which is something you probably didn't want to do. Otherwise, you wouldn't have gone with Wink. But it is an option, and you could basically do that with a smartphone and the mobile app for either platform. Eventually, I would probably buy some smart speakers or smart display because I wouldn't want to use my phone to control everything. It's cloud-centric more so than the others, but you know, it's definitely an option in the broadest space of devices supported, and Matter support for both are coming.
True. So there you go. I would say use this as an incentive to get off Wink if you can.
I would.
Mm-hmm. Take your summer vacation and move platforms.
What I would recommend if you decided to get off Wink, and I agree with you, I think I would. I already have, obviously. I would make a list of all my devices. And unfortunately, I would do a little homework and see what devices are compatible with each of these options, because that's going to determine how many devices you actually need to replace.
Yeah, or maybe the list of devices, you could do it with compatibility in each option, and also think about which ones you use or which is most important to you.
Yeah.
And then also, if you've got a bunch of Z-Wave devices, know that those devices are not going to be updated to Matter. So those are always, like, if your whole home is full of Z-Wave devices, then maybe that becomes less relevant. Maybe you'll just do a wholesale replacement. I know this is kind of a pain. It's very individualized, but it's something to think about.
It is individualized, and I don't disagree with you, but we have heard of some Matter bridges in the works.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I totally think it's going to happen. I'm just like, if your whole home is Z-Wave right now.
Yeah, now's the time to transition.
Or you could spend like $99 on a Hubitat device, although I think the Z-Wave dongle costs a little more, and then you might get a way to flip over. Anyway, it's complicated. That's the bottom line.
It is. It's very complicated.
All right. Speaking of complicated and ending hubs, Hive, which is owned by British Gas, they were actually one of the first smart home providers. They started with a connected radiator device and a connected thermostat because they were owned by British Gas. And then they branched into a bunch of other products. And I feel like they were supposed to come to the US market, but they never really gained much traction here, if they actually came here much at all.
They were here for a little while, but direct sales stopped about 3 years ago, and connectivity for those devices actually stopped in the company's app in November of last year. So they were here. They're not here anymore.
All right. But if you're in Europe, here's the deal. They're going to stop supporting and making devices that are not energy related. So they're not going to sell their security cameras, their security system, even their water leak detection devices. All of those devices, they're going to stop selling them. After September 1st of next year, their water leak detection will stop functioning. And by August of 2025, all of the security systems will stop working.
And that's a pretty generous lead time, I think. I mean, I hate to see any product that people invested in go away and just become a brick, but that is what's happening. No ifs, ands, or buts, but they've given people enough time. I would love to see them give maybe some money, but you know, I don't know what their financial situation is, but at least they gave a really long heads up time.
And if you're like okay with the fact that they're just going smart energy, you can buy the Hive Mini smart thermostat for £119. So, you know, fine. And this lets you control your temperature, and there's a subscription service that costs about £4 a month, and you get scheduling recommendations to save money on energy.
It requires their hub, but it does include it for the £119. So, you know, it's a viable option. If you already have the hub, the thermostat is £59. So that's not so bad.
Yes. So, on one hand, they taketh. On the other hand, they giveth.
Yes.
Basically, they're focusing on smart energy. And we're actually going to hear more about that because our guest this week, Pilgrim, is actually the former CEO of AlertMe, which was bought by British Gas and had provided the back-end infrastructure for another defunct home service, Lowe's Iris, and Hive. So there we go. Stay tuned for him. All right. Let's talk about surveillance because it's another week that we're recording this podcast. So news came out, I think it was late last week or maybe early this week. Time flies when you're on vacation, I'll just tell you. In San Francisco, the city's rules committee is basically trying to figure out how it wants to handle video surveillance. And as part of this, they were saying, hey, let's change our surveillance ordinance, which they developed in 2019, so police don't need to seek authorization from the public before using things like Ring camera devices, so home and other IoT security footage.
I vote no.
They would like to be able to access this. And we'll link to the proposal. It's a government website, so it's actually quite clear in there.
Yeah, they can already use city-owned surveillance cameras, you know, as much as they want.
Well, they can use city-owned cameras. They can't use city-owned cameras that were paid for by grants, believe it or not. They use city-owned cameras that they can't use biometrics and facial recognition on these devices.
Gotcha. The big change here is the use of non-city-owned surveillance cameras. And I mean, to me, that doesn't mean just Ring. That could be from any.
That could be, yeah, any IoT. Yeah. It could be your Wyze camera.
Yeah.
If they had access to it. The thing is, Ring has these partnerships with police agencies that allow them to get access to Ring footage. Normally, you have to have a warrant or a case number, and you go to the owner of the camera, and you say, hey, if you have the case number, you can go to the camera's owner and say, hey, I would like to get this. What this is talking about is saying, is letting the police go with a subpoena to Ring itself and say, hey, I'd like to get access to this. Ring has turned on encryption, two-way encryption, which means that this wouldn't work in those cases. So if you have a Ring device, you can turn that on. But that also means that if you don't have your multi-factor authentication, you also won't be able to see your stuff. So
if I were a Ring owner, which I am not, I would still set up the multi-factor and I would have all that encrypted because...
Yeah, especially if you're like in a major urban area, your Ring camera faces the street where people protest. I mean, yeah. So they also want to do this. They want to access this in real time. And so it would allow for historical access, but it also would allow for real-time access. And related to this... is Senator Markey. We actually talked about this a couple weeks ago. I don't know if y'all recall, he sent a letter to Amazon saying, hey, Amazon, how far away does your Ring video cameras record audio? How often do you give police agencies Ring video footage without people knowing? And a bunch of other questions. So Ed Markey got his responses back from Amazon. And the big takeaway here is Amazon didn't answer a lot of his questions. So they didn't commit to doing some of it. Like, this is politics. He also had some things in here like, Amazon, you should refuse to incorporate voice recognition or image recognition into these cameras. And Amazon was like, yep, we're not going to commit to that. Mm-hmm. But they did report that over 2,000 law enforcement agencies are part of its Neighbors Public Safety Service platform. And that's where police agencies can request footage from Ring users. So over 2,000 agencies in the U.S. can request footage from Ring. This is more than 5x increase in partnerships with law enforcement since November of 2019.
I'm actually okay with that because you as a consumer can say no.
Right. Well, so the other thing is, Amazon has disclosed that it has provided videos to law enforcement in response to an emergency request through a process that doesn't require the consent of the device owner 11 times this year.
And I don't like that. It should be 0 times.
Yeah, they shouldn't have the option to do that. And I know people are like, but public safety, I get it. But it feels like we don't understand the policies that are in place around this.
Yeah.
And Amazon refused to answer a lot of other questions from Markey.
Yeah. And one of the other bits that Amazon refused to do, one of the actions they refused to commit to, which bothers me, is to make end-to-end encryption the default storage option on a Ring camera.
I get why they don't do it. It's going to break some functionality for users. I know. Convenience versus security.
That's the trade-off. It always is. Always will be.
also in the privacy surveillance kind of vein and data collection of all of our connected devices, the FTC this week just posted a blog that basically I read this as them reminding companies that are collecting location data, that are collecting sensitive health data, that in the wake of the Dobbs decision, which eliminated the right to abortion at a federal level, or eliminated the right to privacy that enabled abortion, they're basically say, the FTC says, hey, you know what, y'all? I just want to remind everyone out there collecting this data that it is sensitive and you've got to be real freaking careful with it. So, and the FTC is monitoring and going to go after companies who are selling access to data that they deem sensitive. So they mentioned their settlement with Flow Health, which was a period tracking app, basically saying that the company shared data with third parties and that data was sensitive health information. It also calls companies out for misusing mobile health location information. So basically, if you are a company that could somehow see that a woman has gone to get an abortion and you try to share that with any states or companies that might share that with state or lawmakers, the FTC is not a fan of that and they're going to be looking for that.
I have to say, I mean, I didn't read the settlement with Flow Health, but my biggest issue, not so much the fact that they shared data with third parties, they had previously said they were going to keep that information private.
Yes. And so here's one of the reminders in here. Not just that sensitive data is protected by law, they're also saying that, hey, if you're claiming that data is anonymous or has been anonymized, the FTC is saying that's often deceptive. And if you make those claims about anonymization, you should be on guard that those can be considered deceptive trade practices, which means the FTC is going to come after you.
And so you don't want data, that.
Yeah, you really don't. I mean, the fines aren't huge. You can appeal them. It's going to be a long process, but I would like to see the FTC get more active, and I hope they do. And I think this is interesting. It seems to indicate, because they brought up research, noticing that it was possible to uniquely identify 95% of a data set, a certain amount of individuals using 4 location points with timestamps. So it seems to be that they're indicating that they might do the research and they'll see if someone can be de-anonymized from quote unquote anonymous data.
That should put a little scare in these companies, I think. Again, if the fines aren't big enough, it's not going to matter. I mean, some of these companies are fined $1 million, $2 million. And to you and me, that's a lot of money. But to, say, a Google, a Facebook, Amazon, whatever, that's chump change.
Well, those companies don't want to run afoul of the FTC.
No.
The real issue is if you're a small company, it's a problem. If you're a big company, what's likely to happen is, like, if FTC goes after Google, Google's likely to appeal. Right. And then the FTC will have to defend its case and then it'll go out for years and years. And then eventually we'll get a settlement. I mean, this was on antitrust, but when the FTC went after Microsoft, that took like 15 years. It took a long time.
It was a long time.
Yep. So long. Anyway.
Right. And the large companies can afford to pay the lawyers to keep that going and defend them and so on. Whereas a small company, they're just going to have to suck it up and either pay a fine or whatever.
Yeah. But it would be bad publicity, especially right now, especially on this issue. All right.
Agreed.
Moving away from surveillance and our inadequate laws to protect us against it, let's talk about Home Assistant again. These are some quick news bits from Home Assistant. Home Assistant is now introducing something they're calling Works with Home Assistant. And basically, they're just saying that these companies that will get this designation are actively, this is silly, working with Home Assistant. So people in the Home Assistant community can build integrations for devices, but it's way better if the company who makes the device actually actively works with the user community to build something that works and make sure it stays working. And so that's what this program's all about.
I love this program, and I really like the way they've done these labels. And I know that sounds stupid, but I like them because they're super descriptive. Like, one of the labels is works locally with Home Assistant. One is works via the cloud with Home Assistant. Works with Bluetooth via Home Assistant. So it explains to the consumer right off the bat, before they even buy a product, because this theoretically would be on the product box of a connected device, you know it's going to work and you know how it's going to work.
And speaking of things working with Home Assistant, home assistant, they've been kind of dancing around the matter issue. And it sounds like they're going to basically support matter because they had a workshop on the topic. And it seems like they're doing a lot of work here.
Matter and Home Assistant workshop was last month. I did not attend it or anything. I'm curious how that went. But additionally, that Home Assistant Yellow product hub that we mentioned earlier in the show will come with a Thread radio. So clearly, they've got the momentum going for Matter support.
Okay. And the other big story in our realm is probably...
Hot bottoms.
Hot bottoms. This is my favorite feature on my car, actually. So BMW... is making its heated seats an $18 subscription for cars in Korea. And they're doing this in lieu of outright buying it. So they're basically turning the car gradually into a series of services, is how I would think of it. And people have pretty strong opinions about this. What are yours, Kevin?
Well, just some background, because they've been doing this for a couple of years now. And when they started doing it, I was not happy. Just for clarification, in 2019, if you wanted Apple CarPlay support, it was going to be $80 a year. We had a 2019 Toyota, a RAV4, and for remote access to remotely start or unlock the doors or whatever, there was a fee for that, which we did not pay at that time. So in 2019, I was not happy. I'm not going to say I'm happy by this, and this isn't happening in the U.S. This is South Korea, and I believe... the UK, they have no public plans to bring this model to the US market. But my stance has changed a little bit. It softened up mainly because we purchased a new Tesla Model 3 in May. And while I'm not a fan of subscriptions, I actually see some benefit now that I have the Tesla in that we did not pay for the full self-driving. That's $12,000 as a one-time fee. The car has all of the computer guts and the sensors to do it. So they actually offer it as a monthly subscription for $199 a month.
Oh, that is expensive. I guess if you're going on a road trip, you might be like, oh, I want to get it.
There you go. I would never have paid $12,000, and I still will never pay $12,000 for full self-driving, which isn't even complete yet. However, by making it available as a subscription, it at least gives me that option to try out something for a much lower upfront investment. I can do it for a month on a long road trip, as you said, and try it, maybe enjoy it, maybe hate it, I don't know, but I don't have to pay the $12,000.
So you'd only pay for your heated seats 6 months out of the year when you needed them?
To be honest, yeah, I probably would.
But then you couldn't, this gets to this idea of like people who lease versus buy a car. And like when I buy a car, one, we usually buy our cars used because they depreciate so much when you come right off the lot, right?
Sure.
And then you want to amortize those. We keep our cars for like 10 or 11 years. And over that time, you amortize the cost of the car. So for someone like me, I don't want to pay $18 a month for 10 years. That's way more than those seats are worth, right? And so it's turning everyone into the leasing model, and I don't like it.
And that's the key. It's turning everyone into a single model. So my approach would be, you know, either include it in the price of the car and add it $100 or whatever you normally charge for it, or you disable it and say you're going to buy the car cheaper, and if you want to add this later, it's going to be X dollars a month. For every month that you use it. I'd rather see both models available still rather than an either, you know, rather than all or none, quite honestly.
Yeah. You could think about like what that means for financing. This will be a really interesting shift, and I'm not sure we're ready for it. I'll be honest. I don't think consumers.
I agree. I mean, vehicles in general are, you know, you're right. They depreciate the minute you drive off the lot, except maybe for Teslas. I mean, we looked at used Teslas. They were going to cost us more than a new one because of the crazy situation going on right now with used cars and, you know, supply chain, et cetera. So that's why we didn't get it. And in fact, when we ordered our car in February, we ordered like the mid-range model with no real options other than what it comes with. And between the time we ordered it in February and the time it arrived in May, two price increases bumped up that same exact configuration by $5,000. For anybody who was ordering in May. So it's crazy right now. You know, everything's there so I could use it. And I don't mind paying for something if I'm going to use it. That's my new thought.
All right. I accept. Okay. Well, that concludes the news portion, but stay tuned because now it is the Internet of Things podcast hotline, the section of the show where we hear from y'all. And this week's hotline is sponsored by Silicon Labs. WorksWith by Silicon Labs has emerged as the go-to developer conference for building the skills needed to create impactful connected devices. In September, Silicon Labs is going to bring together global technology brands, ecosystem partners, and industry experts to drive the most exciting advances in the IoT industry. These people are going to present keynotes, they're going to contribute to panel discussions, and lead technical sessions. Learn more at workswith.silabs.com. All right, so if you would like to call us with your questions, you can reach us at 512-623-7424. And when you do call us and ask us your questions, we might answer your question on the show. And if you call us, you will be entered to win this month's prize, which we're going to call it the Hubitat Elevation. Because everybody's smart home systems might be kind of on the fritz because of Wink issues, Insteon issues. I don't know what kind of issues. Or maybe you're just a DIYer who wants to play. We'll get you a Hubitat if you are chosen as our July winner. So give us a call at 512-623-7424. And now let's hear from this week's caller who's asking about networking.
Hi, guys. I'm a fan. My name is Robert. I have about 68 connected devices. All those little devices that I have, I always hear from other sources, keep it on its own network for security reasons and also, I mean, probably traffic because it doesn't, you know, I feel that it just kind of create a lot of chaos in your main network. So what I do is I have an extender. It's an old TP-Link extender. It only has a 2.4, but that's perfect because most cheap switches do a 2.4. So I have all of that in that network. And it works fine. There's no delay. There's really nothing, you know, and it's plugged into a wall all the time. And that goes into the mesh, the Wi-Fi 6 mesh. So my question is that a good way to go about it?
Robert has a solution that seems to be working for him. But I don't think it's working the way he thinks it's working. Because he talks about how we've mentioned very recently, we talked about using guest networks or segmenting your networks to have your IoT devices on one network and your home computers and TVs and whatever else on another network. But if the 2.4 gigahertz extender that he's using, if it just uses the same network name, which...
The same SSID. Yeah, that's what most extenders do.
They're not segmented at all, Robert. It's all one giant network. So if you're looking to do that, I would make a change. I would personally not use an extender like that. Add to your existing mesh network, use the guest network, and that will segment it, and that will also boost your coverage. So that's probably what I would do if that's what you're after, if you're trying to truly segment things. If you're not, and you just want better coverage, and you're using the extender for that, and it's working fine, you keep doing that. That's perfectly fine. But it's not adding any, call them firewalls between your devices and your other, your smart home devices and your computing devices, so to speak. So I'm not a fan of extenders for that reason, because all they do is just give you more range. And I might as well just get a mesh extender at that point with multiple radios, 2.4 and 5 and Wi-Fi 6 and so on. It's more expensive. An extender is usually cheaper. I would just add another mesh access point personally. What do you think?
Yeah, I would just embrace the mesh and ditch the extension. My in-laws have an extender and it is such a pain because then when you're far out, you're like, oh, my Wi-Fi coverage is kind of crappy here. And then you have to go manually switch to the extender. And
So they have one with a different network name, I suppose.
Well, it's like the in-laws network extension is what it is.
Yeah.
And so like those network devices that you might have like out in your garage or whatever the extension is covering, they're still on the same, like they still can communicate with the other devices on your network. So like Kevin said, they're not actually segmented. It's just a messy situation. We've got better technology now. We should use it. Yay. Okay. So Robert, we hope that helps you. We're sorry if it made you go buy a new router. if you do have to go buy a new router, go for Wi-Fi 6. If you're really feeling fancy, you can go for Wi-Fi 6E. You won't need it anytime soon, but if you've got devices or you're in the market for a new computer or laptop, then you might want to get Wi-Fi 6E because then you're future-proof for a little bit longer. But, you know, if that's not in the cards for you to buy new computing gear, I wouldn't worry about it. So remember, if you would like to give us a call and have us answer your questions, we're at 512-623-7424, and you will be entered to win a Hubitat Hub. Woo-woo! All right, that concludes this segment of the show, but please stay tuned for our guest, Pilgrim Beert, who's going to be talking to us about the end of smart home stuff, a focus on smart energy, and what we need to do to get there. So before we get to Pilgrim, we're going to hear from our sponsor, and this week's sponsor is Influx Data. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. And this week's sponsor is Influx Data, the makers of InfluxDB. And I have Brian Gilmore here with me. First up, why don't you tell me, what is InfluxDB?
Well, I think before we talk about InfluxDB itself, we should back up and talk about what time series data is. Time series data, it's all time stamped. So simply any type of data that's time stamped in some way, whether it's every hour, every minute, or every second. And that includes both regular time stamped data, stuff that happens on a regular interval, and irregular stuff, which we call events. All IoT data today is time stamped.
And why does a purposely built time series platform matter for IoT folks?
Everybody's looking for scale and precision, and that is oftentimes very difficult to get with off-labeled or other applications, databases that aren't really designed for time series data. Our entire roadmap is completely focused on the needs of time series developers. And what we try to do is we try to sort of manage that roadmap and deliver capabilities that are critical for developers and operators who are working with, you know, multi-million dollar assets and operations.
And I saw you recently launched a new feature for edge data replication. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We're excited about it. Edge data replication is a new capability that we've built into version 2.2 of our open source distribution. It allows developers who have InfluxDB OSS as well as InfluxDB Cloud to unify them into a single vertically oriented and integrated time series platform. Add to this our ongoing efforts to unify APIs across all of those database offerings, whether it's in the cloud or in the data center or at the edge. And we now have a path for developers to build once and deploy anywhere because it's all managed within our database write path and in our time series processing language called Flux. Edge data replication is durable and scalable in ways we couldn't even imagine 2 years ago.
Why is edge data replication such a big deal for developing IoT apps?
Going back to that sort of purpose-built thing, this is exactly what we mean. IoT, especially enterprise and industrial IoT, are generally highly distributed from both a compute and storage perspective. Data has a point of origin, meaning a place where it's born, typically close by the sensor. A force of gravity, meaning that there's a drive to get to that data from a sort of application and script perspective. And it also has a half-life, meaning that it is most valuable sort of right at the point of generation, and that value declines generally over time. So our edge data replication does exactly this. It brings the horsepower closer to the sensor, and it gives developers and solution builders the ability to leverage their own resources deployed at the edge. And that opens the door for more advanced use cases with better and faster return on investment. Now, InfluxDB should be looked at as a vertically integrated stack with edge and cloud together finally.
This sounds great. So where can people go to find out more about Influx Data and InfluxDB?
Sure. I think the best place to check it out is influxdata.com/Stacy-IoT.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacy Higginbotham, and today's guest is Pilgrim Beert, who is the CEO and co-founder of Device Pilot. Hello, Pilgrim. How are you today?
Hi, Stacey. Very lovely to talk to you. And I'm on holiday today, so hope you don't get too many seaside noises in the background.
We're just going to call it ambiance. So we have known each other for such a long time. You started in this industry with AlertMe, which did the back-end system for Lowe's, I believe. Yes?
Indeed, yes. So we started that back in 2008, which, as you say, is a long time ago.
Man, forever ago.
And I think there's a lot of parallels from back, from Alert Me to what you're doing now. So I just wanted to draw those out. So when you started Alert Me, kind of what was the goal and what ended up happening?
Well, our vision at Alert Me was very much what you would now call the smart home, although we didn't use exactly those words then. And we were looking at what people have been doing with home automation for many decades. And that always seemed to be technically very complicated and very expensive. So it was for rich people and geeks. And we thought, come on, we need to, this is the 2000s, you know, we need to be doing better than this. So we were trying to create what you could call home automation, but for normal people. So stuff that just worked each time, every time, and that was affordable. And that really was our vision. And then within that, we thought, well, what applications do we want to deliver for the smart home? And the three ones we decided made sense in this order were home security, home energy, and then telecare, looking after people as they get older.
And so what happened? I mean, like, I'm still waiting for the smarter smart home. So that clearly didn't happen. And I know that there is a lot of talk. There is a lot of effort around building out products for elder care. But where do you think those segments are?
Yeah, it's frustrating, isn't it, how long it's taking? And there's no one reason for it. Yes, I think it's just because it's technically complicated, but also it's socially complicated. You know, it touches on lots of aspects of people's lives. At Alert Me, we started in home security just because there was a connected home offering from the likes of ADT, which wasn't very good and was very expensive. And we thought, okay, people already understand this and the idea that they might pay a monthly fee for this. So we'll come along with something that's sort of better, faster, cheaper, as it were. And that worked to a point. But we very much believed in sort of co-creation with our customers. So I particularly personally spent a lot of time talking to our early customers just at the point when we had a few hundred of them. And we did surveys and we reached out to people. I mean, quite often we were talking to people because we were having to support our technology in their house when it wasn't working properly. We had a very close relationship with those early customers. And we really used that to help steer the company. So when we put a load of different offerings in front of them and said, okay, you've got home security from us, what would you like next? We offered them, I think, 10 different things they could have, everything from a smart plug to a home thermostat to a thing for watching whether their house plants needed watering, you know, all sorts of things. And the very clear feedback, even this was back in 2008, 2009, was that people wanted energy management because it was financially important to them. And also impacted their comfort. So that was really, you know, we were pulled by our early customers into smart energy from having started initially with security.
And it turns out the work that you did with Alert Me, Lowe's killed Iris, and then British Gas was another customer. And actually just this last week, they killed most of their Hive stuff. They kept actually the smart energy segment. So what do you think this says about the smart home market just broadly?
I think it goes back to what we originally thought when we started Alert Me, which was that people don't want a very diverse set of geeky products. They want a few things that work that work really well and do important things for them. So it was very notable when we had Lowe's as a customer and had British Gas as a customer, the difference in approach. I mean, British Gas, utility company, obviously energy was the thing that they wanted to focus on, whereas Lowe's very much wanted as many devices as possible on the platform, you know, tens and tens and tens. I think there was something like 60 different devices that we supported on the Iris platform. And obviously, it takes a lot of effort to support every device and make sure it's working properly. And if you divide your effort by 60 different devices from different manufacturers, you can be pretty sure you're not going to do an excellent job for all of them. And it almost inevitably pulls you in that home automation direction, you know, rich people and geeks. I always say if you walk into a rich person's house, you discover all sorts of things that don't work properly. And the reason for that is that only rich people buy them. And with such a small volume of customers, the manufacturers just can't afford to make the quality good. You know, it takes a lot of effort to make a complex technology product work well. And that's something that, you know, Apple can do with billions of dollars, making actually a relatively small number of products. I think the key point really is that you have to focus and do one thing really well.
That bodes ill for my smart home. Okay. So let's go to what you're doing now, because after Alert Me, it was acquired by British Gas, you started Device Pilot. And talk to me about what your thoughts were with that.
Yeah, well, that went back really to the early days of the British gas relationship as AlertMe. So this was probably about 2012, 2011. And we had about 8,000 customers with them. And they did an assessment of Net Promoter Score and so on and worked out that actually this had a transformative effect on their brand. So it was something they really, really wanted to do. And I remember the particular meeting one day where they turned around to us and said, okay, so by this date, we're going to have 20,000 customers. By this date, we're going to have 100,000. By this date, we're going to have 1 million. And we were kind of nodding and smiling and all the rest of it. But after that meeting, we looked at each other and thought, oh my God, how are we going to do this? Because we started off having to do a lot of R&D to design the devices and get them manufactured and write all the software and so on. And actually, we were still in that mindset, really, of sort of R&D, building it. But now we had thousands of customers and we were going to have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of customers. And that requires a completely different mindset. It's not about building it anymore because you've more or less worked out how to do that by then. It's about running it. So you've got this growing estate of customers and you better be keeping them really happy. Otherwise, you're going to have a growing stream of complaints and bad news stories and so on in the press. So getting that operational stuff right, it becomes everything. I mean, that becomes the number one job of the company forevermore. And that was a really painful transition for us at AlertMe, partly because we hadn't really anticipated that that's what would be necessary, but also we just hadn't got the tools to do it. And so we had to build them. And it took us a couple of years to do that, during which we were spending a lot of time and money sort of throwing people at the problem with, so basically just trying to use good manual customer support to keep the wheels on, paper over the cracks of technology issues and support the customers. And that's a very inefficient thing to do. So we sort of survived that, but it was a painful learning, painful lesson for me. So really, that was the inspiration for Device Pilot. We thought, well, all these companies that are doing connected devices in the home and elsewhere are going to hit this same problem. And they may do it like us, not really realizing that it's coming, but it's suddenly going to hit them when they've got 1,000 customers or 10,000 customers or whatever. And there should be a generic solution to this generic problem of managing devices at scale efficiently, being able to see what's going on, being able to automate actions to resolve issues in an efficient way. So you're not throwing people at the problem. You know, some people call it fleet management. Some people call it network assurance or service management is the phrase we usually use. But it's essentially a suite of software that lets you see how well you're serving the customer and lets you close the gap when you see what it is. So, you know, we've got these hardware problems, these software problems. What actions are we going to take to resolve those problems? Has it worked? Have we driven the quality up? You know, is our quality at 95%, 97%, 98%, and so on?
How is that different from device management or just like telemetry data about the devices in the field?
Yes. Well, unfortunately, terms are quite confusing here because if you went to a man or woman in the street and asked them what device management was, they might describe quite what we do, but actually technically it's something quite different. So from a technical perspective, device management is the low-level software which does the very important things like establishing a secure connection with the devices between the devices and the cloud, upgrading firmware, sending commands to the devices, getting telemetry from the devices. I mean, that's all absolutely essential stuff, but you'll need that for your first device or your first 10 devices, and then you'll go on using that stack forevermore. What we do is a layer above that. So what we're doing is measuring whether the device is actually doing whatever it's supposed to do. So if it was a Coca-Cola vending machine, device management would be down in the weeds dealing with software updates and so on. But what we're doing is we're measuring, is this machine actually doing what it's intended to do? So is it actually serving people Coca-Cola? If not, why not?
Got it. And we don't have like a magic quadrant for this yet. We don't know what this is called.
No, there's a category problem still. Everyone calls it something different.
You started this company and the thinking there was that you were going to get involved in similar areas as you did with AlertMe?
Yeah, so a little bit like AlertMe, we started off with quite a general vision because we thought this problem of managing devices effectively at scale applies to every device. It doesn't matter what sector it's in. And so we started off building a platform that could do that because essentially the challenge of managing a device is quite common no matter what the device does. I mean, I just used an example of a Coca-Cola vending machine, but it could be, you know, absolutely any other device, a smart home device or anything else. So we built a product which could do that for any device. And we launched it and we got some early customers in a whole variety of different verticals. And to some extent, that proved our hypothesis that one product could solve this problem for many different verticals. However, as time went on, we kind of noticed that some were more important and successful than others. And in particular, smart energy was an area which was changing very fast, which was growing very fast with huge financial and almost laws of physics dynamics behind it, which were causing it to grow. You know, if you're a startup, you want to serve a market which is being disrupted, because that will give you an opportunity to get into the market and serve it and grow with it without having to fight against lots of incumbents. And that's absolutely what's happening in smart energy. So the whole of our world is being turned upside down because of the move to renewables and all the implications of that. And that creates a massive opportunity for companies that are involved in smart energy. And we actually got an early customer called Podpoint, who do EV charging. And about 4.5 years ago, they became one of our first sort of keystone customers. And we've grown with them and learned a lot from serving them. And I think we've helped them a lot in their growth path. So they got acquired by EDF, the large French energy company, last year, and then they went public this year. During that time, we've seen them grow by orders of magnitude in terms of the number of devices they provide.
And so your software is making sure their chargers are working, delivering energy in an appropriate manner?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in that case, you need to always think like the end user. The end user cares about it in that they drive their car to somewhere where there are some chargers and they want to charge their car. So you could call it things like site availability, you know, would be a good metric for that. So if they can't charge their car, that might be because there's a hardware problem or a software problem, maybe a physical problem with the chargers. Or it might just be that all the chargers are in use. You know, there isn't a technical problem there. If you looked at technical metrics like uptime, that's 100%. But there's still a service problem because there are no chargers available. Maybe you need to deploy more chargers on that site. So I think that kind of helps to illustrate perhaps the difference between what we do and more technical metrics, which only care about things like uptime.
Got it. Okay. That was actually very helpful. Okay. So let's talk about smart energy, because I feel like, yes, you're right. This is hugely disruptive. It's going to be fast moving, except it will also probably be slow moving because there's a lot of regulatory kind of implications here. And it's just, energy is such a huge part of our economy. We can't just flip it with a switch, right? So I feel like there are three things. Let me know if I'm missing anything that are really changing the game here. One, the use of renewables changes the supply of energy. It makes it more dynamic, which can be hard because you really just want energy to always be there. Two, you've got the electrification of everything. So moving away from gasoline powered vehicles, for example, or, you know, using heat pumps instead of fuel in homes. And so all of that is driving more demand for energy. And then three, I feel, is resiliency. We're in a time of climate change where our grids are going down, things are happening, it's hard to anticipate. Am I missing any other big trends that are really kind of changing the game for energy?
No, I think you've done that's a really good 3-point bullet list there. I think I might use that myself.
You're welcome to it. So what are the sorts of things that your customers are focused on?
Yeah, well, as I think a result of all three of those points you mentioned, what's happening, whether it's existing players who already serve the energy market, or whether it's new and people coming into the market, of which there are many, what tends to happen is that these new technologies, they come smart enabled because the cost of making something smart is now so low and the value of making something smart is now so high. You know, energy is a really expensive thing and getting significantly more expensive at the moment. And so adding a little bit of smarts to manage thousands of dollars of energy a year can make a lot of sense. If we look at all the devices that are coming into the home from an energy perspective, and you mentioned heat pumps, there are all sorts of other kind of heat stores, you know, everything from hot water tanks that don't mix the water too much, phase change tanks that can store about three times as much heat through, you know, thermostats in home displays and so on. All these things are intrinsically smart, and that creates massive opportunities, but it also creates potential complexity and risk because, of course, putting a load of software in something intrinsically could make it less reliable.
I feel like there's a big play here for regulation, and I'm thinking at a bunch of different levels. So at one level, you've got government saying things like no more installation of gas appliances inside new homes. You also have governments with building codes saying, hey, you need to put a smart thermostat in to help manage this. And then we also have governments like California, for example, is looking for standards and ways to have utilities communicate things like real-time pricing. The public utility commissions are trying to regulate how that information might be relayed between the power companies, power suppliers, and the users of that power. What are the most effective regulations you think that will help drive this intelligence into the grid?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating subject. And there are so many case studies of it being done well and being done badly. And of course, it's this dance between really, I suppose, the three parties of government, companies, and end users, and all the decisions they're all making independently. And it's quite hard for government to force things to happen. I remember EV mandates in California in the early 2000s, where they said, you know, a certain percentage shall be EVs by this date, and it just didn't happen. So government can't just sort of regulate things into existence. But on the other hand, of course, it can tilt the playing field and make it economically attractive and guarantee a certain, you know, pricing and so on, which can then make it possible for commercial entities to go and do things. I think an area where government certainly has an influence, and it can be positive or negative, is the whole area of sort of standards for openness. I think in the UK, we saw it not being done particularly well in the early days of smart meters, so in the sort of 2010 timescale. Government got right into the thick of the technical details of how smart meters would work. And frankly, you know, that's not a subject that most governments understand very well. And it ended up being very overspecified and very, very awkward. I think a better level is if government kind of stays at the outcome level, you know, it mandates that certain things shall happen without necessarily specifying exactly how. And then the industry will probably come up with some standards that help them all achieve that. And we've seen that more recently, for example, with EV charging in the UK. So now every new home has to have an EV charger outside it. And all EV chargers now have to be smart. So they have to be remote disconnectable, and they have to be able to do smart metering. And, you know, government has done that, though, at quite a high level by just literally saying what I just said without being too prescriptive about exactly how it works.
Yes. Now, I do think with things like charging, you will want to have something happening locally as well. But just from a degradation in case of failure kind of situation.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think absolutely. I think to your point about resilience, making sure everything does the right thing, even if it doesn't have communication, is absolutely essential. And also worrying about emergent problems. If you've got millions of smart devices on the grid, you don't want them to all behave the same in that case. So if there's a big outage of the cellular network or an electricity outage or whatever, you absolutely do not want all the devices to suddenly do the same thing in response. Otherwise, you'll have gigawatts of extra load on your grid unexpectedly. And I mean, this has been thought about decades ago. So electronic heating controls, you know, that have been common for decades, the very simple ones. One of the things they do is if there's a power cut, after the power cut, they wait a random time before they turn the heating on again. And that's to make sure that you don't just suddenly get a massive surge of load just when the grid's trying to get back up again. So I think there's all sorts of issues of resilience that need to be thought about.
All right. Pilgrim, thank you so much for coming on the show this week. I really appreciate it.
It's been lovely talking to you, Stacey.
And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things podcast. Please join us next Thursday, and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stacyonIoT.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. Once again, thank you for listening, and please subscribe.